Tonight on Arena, we celebrate the 80th birthday of the much-loved poet Paul Durkin, and The Apprentice and Kathleen Is Here are the movies up for review. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. One of our most beloved poets, Paul Durkin, has turned 80 years of age to celebrate the occasion. A new volume of his selected works, Paul Durkin 80 at 80, has been published. First published himself in 1967, Durkin is the most companionable of poets. The goings-on of Ireland have been the preoccupation of his life's work, in turn delighting, enriching and unsettling his reader. Tonight on Arena, I'm joined by Colm Tobin, Paula Meehan and Dermot Bulger to celebrate the life and work of Paul Durkin. But there would be no Hamlet without the Prince. There would be no celebration without the poet in his own voice and words. While Paul has not done a poetry reading in many years, his voice, I think, for so many people still rings strong, true and mischievous through the ages. Let's listen to him reading Making Love Outside Áras an Uachtaráin.
When I was a boy, myself and my girl used bicycle up to the Phoenix Park. Outside the gates, we used to lie in the grass, making love outside Áras an Uachtaráin. Often I wondered what De Valera would have thought inside in his ivory tower if he knew that we were in his green, green grass, making love outside Áras an Uachtaráin. Because the odd thing was, oh, how odd it was, we both revered Irish patriots, and we dreamed our dreams of a green, green flag, making love outside Áras an Uachtaráin. But even had our names been Diarmaid and Gráinne, we doubted De Valera's approval. For a poet's son and a judge's daughter, making love outside Áras an Uachtaráin. I see him now in the heat haze of the day, blindly stalking us down, and levelling an ancient rifle, he says, "Stop," making love outside Áras an Uachtaráin.
Making Love Outside Áras an Uachtaráin, read by Paul Durkin, who is 80 this week. Yesterday, in fact, I think, was his birthday. We are here to discuss a new book, looking back on his poetry, with writer and friend Dermot Bulger, Colm Tobin, who has written the introduction to Paul Durkin, 80 at 80, and poet Paula Meehan. And the minute you hear the voice, it's the first thing you say in the introduction, in fact, Colm, Paul Durkin's voice. It's the first three words that you have in that introduction. He's inimitable, and he just has this phenomenal delivery style.
Yeah, you would hear him on the radio in those years. I think for anyone listening would remember just the extraordinary mixture of comic timing and a sort of dead seriousness and earnestness. And the fact that the most outrageous image could emerge, closeted in some other further sort of statement that would be sometimes very simple, and sometimes unusual, in that his mind was always working towards something that was not... He wasn't interested in surrealism, but he managed to be serious without ever being solemn. He was against solemnity and in favour of seriousness, but his seriousness, of course, was always comic as well. And he just loved... I think the poems he made were made with extraordinary amount of care. It seems as though they were made for a conversation, for a voice, for an ordinary voice sometimes. But actually, I think there's a great deal. I don't know. Mm. I think there's a great... You can just see how hard it is to get that tone started.
Yeah.
That would take the work. And he would spend a lot of time. I mean, he still spends a lot of time just there working on that.
And it's the simplicity of the language that strikes me again and again. And yet the depth of... the comedy, the emotion, the feeling, the political message, the anger, all of these things and many other things besides that are in the poems.
You never saw Paul without those little tiny notebooks, little schoolboy notebooks, and everything was written down, and it was all, everything became, went in there, and then they came out in these extraordinary things that were, I always thought they were like, if you look at a spoon in a glass of water, it refracts, and so you're looking at something real and something unreal. Mm. And Paul managed to create that universe that was, it was really, really intimate, it was really, really personal, and yet it was really, really strange. And Cavafy said that the Greek poet, a poet should stand at a peculiar angle to the universe, and Paul came at everything with great humility, with great humour, with great sensitivity from his own angle, and that's what makes him so, it's easy to copy because no one had, he's so original that nobody had ever, there was never a voice like him before in Irish writing, and hopefully there will be many voices like him afterwards.
And Paula, you've spoken about this idea, which I love, that it's not an audience that Paul Durkin had or has at a reading, it's a congregation.
Yeah, I mean, he's the great artist of the transformation in the moment of performance, and you would actually be sitting on the edge of your chair with him in the moment that he's creating. And you know, he's great at poking the audience as well, both in the text and in the performances. So you know that you're part of his bigger spell. And he does have devotees, like especially, you know, in the heyday, the 80s, the 90s, where he was out on the road a lot. Mm. And you'd go along and like, I mean, people were rapt, and even the people he's poking at, like especially the Dublin middle class, they're lapping it up. They're loving every minute of it. And so there's this entertainment, but beyond it, there's such serious intent. I was in Derek Mahon's workshop when he was in Trinity there, and he brought in a poem one day and distributed it, and he said, "Who is this?" And everyone went, "Oh, that's Paul Durkin." And he said, "No, actually, I wrote that myself last night." But he was warning us as well about, you know, that Paul was unique. He was inimitable. And that we really have to watch out that we don't be so taken with the superficial allure that we think it's easy.
Yeah, because it's easy to think that the style of delivery is going to be enough. He has brilliant comic timing. I mean, if you listen to that poem, how he uses the word stop and waits for the delivery of the poem's title again. I mean, it is absolutely masterful.
What was also extraordinary about his readings, and I was backstage at many readings, I'm sure Colm and Paula were, was that he genuinely suffered from nerves. He genuinely was terrified going on. And I've run a lot of poets, and they just go on, they read a poem, it doesn't mean anything to them. But Paul actually lived every poem he ever read, and he was absolutely a level of great intensity and great nervousness before it.
You're a long-time friend as well as a fellow writer, Dermot. When did you first meet him?
I met him in, there was a book of poems published when I was a schoolboy, an anthology when I was a schoolboy, and Paul was in it. And we were launched in the Clare Wills Theatre, which is now gone. And I was around 15 and I wasn't meant to read. And Paul Duggan said, no, Dermot should read. And we became friends. I was a publisher for three books. But I mean, Colm and Paul would know him equally well, and loads of people would know him equally well. But he's been a benediction in my life for the bones of almost 50 years now.
A benediction. What a wonderful way to describe the work of a person. We asked you to have a look at some of the poems that maybe speak to you in particular ways, maybe about his style or about his ability or just something that you like. You've chosen The Cabinet. For us, Paula.
The Cabinet Table, yeah.
The Cabinet Table, I beg your pardon, yeah.
And
this is it's a relatively early poem, isn't it? It comes from the Berlin Wall
Cafe. It's 1985.
Yeah, so it's kind of middle, when he was at the height of his powers, really, in the mid-80s.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, he had many manifestations. Mm. And peak moments, but it was just that he was out there so much. It was so easy to find him and go to his readings. And I have to say, with his books, I mean, the Niall was saying that he had to look at Niall McMonagall,
who edited the collection. Yeah.
He looked at nearly 2,000 poems to put this 80 at 80 together. So, I mean, he's fantastic. I love the idea. It's nearly a Paul Durkin poem of Paul Durkin's all his books in serried ranks in the Ivan Boland Library, which is another thing we're celebrating at the moment. You know?
Absolutely.
It is like a Paul Durkin poem. I was in the Ivan Boland Library. And this is the cabinet table. Alice Gunn is a cleaner woman down at government buildings. And after 7 o'clock mass last night, isn't it a treat to be able to go to Sunday mass on a Saturday, to sit down to Saturday night TV, knowing you fulfilled your Sunday obligation? She came back over to the flats for a cup of tea. I offered her sherry, but she declined. I never touch sherry on a Saturday night. Whatever she meant by that, I don't know. She had us in stitches, telling us how, one afternoon after a cabinet meeting, she got one of the security men to lie down on the cabinet table, and what she didn't do to him, and what she did do to him, she didn't half tell us. But she told us enough to be going on with. Do you know what it is? She says to me. No, says I. What is it? It's mahogany, she says. Pure mahogany.
The absolute audaciousness of that final section of that poem is extraordinary. Yeah. That's Paula Meehan reading for Paul Durkin's poem, The Cabinet Table. Which will never, mahogany will never be the same again when I see it.
It's a poem of the 80s. And if you remember the 80s, I mean, the country was a major basket case, you know, from the moving statues to the Eighth Amendment. I mean, the absurdity, he was like a one-man theatre of the absurd, that he could just nail and channel the voices of the absurdities.
That's true. And poems like The Irish Hierarchy Bans Colour Photography, the Man Who Fell in Love with a Semi-State Body, they were extraordinary at the time. And what was extraordinary also, there was an amazing magazine called In Dublin, which Colm edited. And every fortnight it came out, and there was a Paul Durkin poem. And so Paul had this outlet to talk to people. And there was all kinds of other interesting things in that in Dublin. And it was a great
time. Yeah, we made
an
agreement. I mean, and the poems would arrive on absolutely on the dot for the deadline. And they would be perfectly made. And they became a book called Walking the Train Tracks with Angela eventually. But I think in those years, he was writing these public poems. You know, we can think about the cabinet table and think around the cabinet table, the government is discussing. No. The word cabinet table has now been transformed. And he would do the same with the hierarchy. But what he began to do then in two books was to enter into his, to write about himself in ways that for an Irish man to do was so unusual and strange, to write about his marriage and to write about his relationship to his father and then to his mother. What was interesting about all that was that he remained really secretive. It's like before readings, he would go into a world completely of his own. He could make sounds, but he would be completely separated from whatever was going on for about an hour beforehand. But for a new book coming out in those years, he would also disappear almost. And he certainly, I had no clue when Daddy Daddy came, and I had no clue when the Berlin Wall Cafe came, that these poems even existed.
Yeah.
But the book, and then one day would arrive in the post, and it really, I've never been, the experience of it was, you would turn the page, poem after poem, realize Paul has transformed himself. He's done something entirely new. And that these poems will always be there when people are thinking about love and marriage or about parents, that he has actually recreated some of these words or worlds in his own likeness. But so confessional, so private and so personal. And the element of seeking not just the truth, but some element in the lines of the poem that would surprise still. Some you know, doubling over of things. Almost like sherry. I never have sherry on a Saturday. I don't know why. Like that would come in suddenly.
Yeah.
I think Paul is still, like that extraordinary idea of him thinking as he feels.
Yes, yeah.
Which really, I think, characterises those poems.
Because it feels conversational. It's anything but that. But he manages to get that into the rhythm of the poem. What about the move towards poetry, Dermot? How did it come out of his early life and out of his family background?
I'm not quite sure. He was born in Dublin, lived in Dartmouth Square. His father was a judge, but he had very deep roots in Mayo. and and very proud that his mother, and probably Paul's greatest poem for me is Golden Mother's Driving West, when his mother has Alzheimer's. It's an extraordinary poem, but his mother was linked to Major John McBride and the McBride family, and so there was always that duality within Paul that he was a Mayo man in Dublin and a Dublin man in Mayo. And I don't know when he began to write, but it was I can't imagine Paul ever doing any other. I know himself and Michael Hartnett went to London when they were quite young and were the two worst Secure Corps guards in the history of things. I think they lasted around 2 weeks, but this is the only time I'm ever aware of Paul actually doing anything other than poetry.
And was it difficult to, was it difficult for him to, you know, to move in that poetry direction, coming from the legal background in particular of his father?
I've no idea. To be honest, Paul was born unique, and his voice was unique, and his voice was there even in the very in Ensville, which published him with Brian Lynch in 1967, which Brian Lynch's mother paid for. You can pick up any poem there, and that's uniquely Paul Durkin, and that's up all the way up to his most recent book. You know, there was, I think he was just one, like Hartnett himself, who emerged from Newcastle West at age 15 with that perfect voice. I mean, Paul was like that, and so I think I couldn't imagine Paul being anything other than a poet.
I want to listen to him reading Hymn to My Father, which touches on the difficulty of the relationship he had with his father. What astonishes me about this poem was something that you were talking about there, Colm. Yes, it's very personal. You couldn't call it confessional, but he's discovering things about this relationship. You almost feel he's discovering it as he delivers and writes the poem. Let's have a listen to Hymn to My Father, Paul Durkin reading.
Dear Daddy, on your last legs now, can you hear me in your bedroom in the treetops, chained to your foot warmer and your pills? Death notices in newspapers, your exclusive reading. We had no life together, or almost none. Yet you made me what I am, a man in search of his Russia. After school days, I became a poet, a metamorphosis you could no more fathom than I could fathom your own osmosis, lawyer with a secret life, as secret as the life of a poet. You had a history for every milestone, a saga for every place name, the Bovril sign, the ballast office clock, the broadstone. And so, at your knee, at your elbow, I became you. Estranged as we are, I am glad that it was in this life I loved you, not the next. O Russian night at the crossroads. If you turn to the right, you will lose your horse. To the left, your head. If you go straight on, your life. If you were me, which you are, night at the crossroads, you would go home to Russia this very night.
Hymn to My Father, read by Paul Durkin. I listened to that about 3 or 4 times today and read it on the page, and every time something new comes out of it and really strikes you. But it's the expression of both this estrangement and this love, and I am you, that he's saying directly to. It's an extraordinary achievement.
I think that he managed, as most poets do, to invent a number of fathers.
Yeah.
And the first father, I think, was a teacher in Gonzaga, who he talks about a lot, is a priest who talked to them about Patrick Kavanagh. And he talked about how important this poet was, who had transformed the ordinary into the luminous, and who was living among us, who's in the city now, boys. And for some reason, the young Paul Durkin thought this was an extraordinary idea, and he got to know Kavanagh. And of course, Kavanagh loved him, and he loved Kavanagh, and he was an acolyte, you know. But he was wonderful about Kavanagh one night in a pub, just saying, "There's nothing wrong with anyone in this company that a shower of fivers wouldn't cure." You know, it wasn't like he was just one. The other person, of course, was Anthony Cronin, who became another sort of father to him. And but you know he was very much. I think he was very proud of the fact that in one of the poems he has his father running the fairest court. I mean, his father was a judge. Mm. Were the fairest court in the west of Ireland. This sense of probity of Judge Durkin, but also the other side of the family, the McBrides. I mean, he knew Maud. Look, he knew Maud gone. as a child, which is more than you did, I did, or anything here did. And the idea of being brought to the bed of Maud Gonne so she could see the next member of the generation is not nothing.
And the extraordinary last line of that poem, well, the McBride family always brought everybody to, you know, every newborn McBride to visit Maud, and but they never forgot that she was a bad wife. You know, it's it.
Wow, is that there? I forgot
it's
that.
It's just in the knife, and then he gets frightened and runs off, and Sean McBride comes, Gus and Sean comes and brings him back to the bed. He's only a tiny child.
Another thing that struck me today, you know, they talk about, oh, get the first line of your poem right or get the last line of your poem right. Boy, did he know how to do a title of a poem. Mm. You know, you just read down through the titles of everything here. Sometimes almost like newspaper headlines in some other world. Cardinal dies of heart attack in Dublin brothel. Then you have the serious title like The Divorce Referendum Ireland, 1986. You know, they have this kind of real political and of the moment feel to them. And you have chosen a poem, Dermot, which equally has that, it's of the moment. It's like a newspaper headline.
And it's Paul is 80. It's also 40 years since I tried to give away a copy of Paul Dawkins' Jesus Breakers Fall to every school in Ireland, and I got banned by the VEC with one Fine Gael politician being particularly vociferous and saying that he wouldn't have Paul Dawkins walk in the house. And it's absolutely wondrous now that he's on the Leaving Cert and that children love him and that they really want Paul Dawkins to come up on the exam. So it's wonderful. But I was Paul's publisher at a time when he was being published in Dublin, and I remember being like, myself and the poet Michael Lockton being around like 21 years of age, and it was a terrible disgrace that I was Paul's publisher at 21, because it just showed how Ireland wasn't quite ready to recognise him. And reading this poem about Sid Vicious in manuscript form, sitting there in my father's house one night, and it's called The Debt by Heroine of Sid Vicious. There, but for the clutch of luck, go I. At daybreak, in the Arctic fog of a February daybreak, shoulder-length helmets in the watchtowers of the concentration camp caught me out in the intersecting arcs of the swirling searchlights. There were at least a zillion of us caught out there, like ladybirds under a boulder. But under the microscope, each of us was unique. Unique. And we broke for cover, crazily breasting the barbed wire. And some of us made it to the forest edge, but many of us did not make it, although their unborn children did, such as you, whom the camp commandant branded Sid Vicious of the Sex Pistols. Jesus, break his fall. There, before the clutch of luck, go we all. That was from February 1979.
Yeah, and that's from Jesus, Break His Fall was also the title of the title of the collection in which that is. And that facility to take something that sounds as if it's a newspaper headline, as I say, but then it becomes something totally, totally different, Colm.
Yeah, he was interested in prayer, in the whole idea almost. He takes his Catholicism very seriously, in the sense, without being a believing Catholic, but nonetheless the idea of the numinous, of the luminous, of faith, of the spirit, these things really matter to him. So he's unusual in that respect, in that so much Irish poetry is oddly secular. But he took from Kavanagh some idea that within the stone that there was a God, and that God could be freely and easily mentioned. And you get Sid Vicious just the beautiful tenderness of Jesus Break His Fall. Whatever way, even wherever you read it there, I just like that takes a lot of work. In other words, to make that move.
And there are so many elements of Kavanagh, of later Kavanagh, who understood humour and understood that you had to let go. And you had to just go in new ways. And not into Paul's life. So for several years, I would bring Paul shopping every Monday morning in, and we'd have a little breakfast in a little cafe in Ringsend. And then he'd go across to the church and he'd just sit in silence for 10 minutes in the church. And then he would always say, that altar was done by Patrick Pearse's father. And if there's ever beauty in a Catholic church, it was done by Patrick Pearse's father,
and
that Manchester Unitarian.
That aspect of his life is really interesting, Paul, I think, given the particular, you know, involvement of church and state and the difficulties that were there for a long time, but particularly in the 1980s, in and around the divorce referendum. The last line in that poem gets me. He's talking about somebody up on the altar giving a sermon about the divorce referendum and what you could and couldn't do. And the last line says, I say unto you, preacher and orators of the hierarchy, do not bring ideology into my house of prayer. And that touches on what Dermot is saying there. Despite his annoyance at the hierarchy. It was a secret place for him.
He was a deeply religious man. A deeply spiritual man.
He is.
And in fact, he is, yeah. And he steps right into that space, the sacred space of the poem itself, of the standing there, 2 foot down on the ground, and absolutely owning that sacred space. And I think that's when people went to hear him, that they came away with something deep inside them that had been changed.
But he never runs away from the politics of the situation either.
No, well, he can't, you know, I mean, because that is his truth, to speak the truth as he sees it, you know. But I mean, the thing is that he speaks it in a way that is riveting and entertaining to some degree. I mean, I know that of all the books of his I've had and of all the other poets I have, his books are the ones that have most been robbed. You know, if you lend them to somebody, you don't get
don't
them
come
back.
No. Yeah.
You know, people want them. And I would have brought his poems into the most unusual of places. I think you were in the writers and in the prison scheme when we were young.
Yeah.
You know, to take work into the prisons, to do these workshops with prisoners. And, you know, you just felt the mercy of Paul Durkin that you could bring him
could
in
bring
and people
in.
Would go, oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
And right in there, you know, this is a mercy. In a time when we, you know, our eyeballs were melting at some of the drudgery of poetry readings. You
and
know,
you could read Paul in prison, you could read Paul in prison. But I remember being with him in Halifax, Nova Scotia in 19-something. And he read The Kilfenor Tea by and all the great poems. And was a very perplexed elderly American academic sitting beside me. And, you know, he said, would he get away with that in Ireland? and there was, I think, that Paul had just broken all the rules and all those neat ideas about Irish literature that this man had made his living with for 50 years had just gone out the window because there was somebody just totally startlingly new.
Yeah, and he was hugely popular. Never mind getting away with it in Ireland. He was hugely popular in a way that I don't think poets had been or a poet had achieved up until that point in time, I think you could argue. You mentioned column Six Nuns Die in Convent in Inferno. Again, the religious aspect is here, but he has a kind of a, I don't know how to describe his attitude to nuns.
So how would you describe it?
We
were talking about the poem. I was talking about this poem before we came on, that you know, this was a terrible fire that happened in the Loretta Convent in Stephen's Green. So the headline is absolutely right, that there were six nuns die in Convent Inferno, and he does, to the happy memory of six Loretta nuns who died between midnight and morning of 2nd of June 1986. And then he begins to imagine not only the event, but he begins to reimagine the nunhood, the nunness of the nuns. And he sees this as something gorgeous and slightly crazy. And he sees their death, instead of this awful, tragic business, as something transformative, the transfiguration. But I'm making the poem seem too serious. But it is sometimes very serious. It's a longish poem. I'm certainly not going to read all of it.
But just
to give you a sense of this is the beginning of a section. Now he's moving into the voices of the nuns. I was an old nun. He's very good, by the way, at things like opening poems. I mean, the opening line of a poem. For example, the opening line of this poem is, we resided in a Loretta convent in the centre of Dublin City. Now, he often does this at the opening of a poem, meaning so that your defences are not up immediately. I think this is going to be an ordinary poem about some, you know, it's going to be a lament for these poor nuns. I was an old nun, an aged beadswoman, but I was no daw. I knew what a weird bird I was. I knew that when we went to bed, we were as eerie and avery as you'd find in the blown-off rooftops of the city, scuttling about our dorm, wheezing, shrieking, croaking in our yellowy corsets, wonky suspenders, strung-out garters, a bony crew in the gods of the sleeping city. And I leave it at that, but I promise you, if you go on with this poem, you will find, leaps of imagination that really move beyond control before the poem comes back into control, out of control. But the imagery is really startling. And you think, this is one of the poems, I think, that, you know, it was marvellous when Paul would read it. But I think here now on the page, we're looking at something fundamentally crazy, fundamentally outlandish, and also so satisfying that you go, it isn't possible he's just said. Look what he just said. And now, I mean, that was 1986. You think Ireland has surely changed. But talking like that about anything, including nuns, will always be, I think, something memorable, strange, that he did like no one else.
Yeah, and I can't find the title of it right now, but there's another great poem involving nuns and a car wash, which is worse.
Oh, yes, where the nuns are peering in the back window while the poet and someone else, a girl, are making love in the car. There's a nun. Yes, there is.
And so there's a lot of short poems, Sister Agnes, that Paul reads occasionally about when she's in the convent and she's pregnant and so on. And they're all delighted talking to adopt her.
Phenomenal stuff. We have but scraped the surface, but what an enjoyable scrape it was. Thank you to all three of you for being with us this evening. Colm Tobin, Dermot Bulger and Paul O'Meehan. Paul Durkin, 80 at 80 is published by Harvill and Secker. It will be launched at a special event in the Gate Theatre on Monday, October the 21st. Paul O'Meehan, Colm Tobin and Dermot Bulger, whose play Home Boys Home has transferred from the Civic to the Viking in Clontarf and runs until the 26th of October. As I say, thank you to all of you and enjoy the 21st in the Gate Theatre. Tomorrow sees the return of The Devil's Hour to Prime Video. In Series 1, we met Lucy Chambers, social worker, played by Jessica Raine, who has woken every night at exactly 3:33 a.m. after experiencing terrible visions during the so-called Devil's Hour. Lucy's name in Season 1 became inextricably connected to a string of brutal murders as she was drawn into the hunt for a mysterious killer, Gideon, played by Peter Capaldi. Both Raine and Capaldi star in Season 2. Earlier in the week, I spoke to both of them. Before we hear that chat, let's listen to a little of what we can expect in Season 2 of Devil's Hour.
Deja vu. Makes you feel like you've experienced all this before.
You told me the worst thing that ever happened to you. I stopped it.
Remember, Lucy, remember.
I remember everything.
I can't stop it now, but you can.
What is going to happen?
You look at me and you see the devil incarnate. The real devil's out there. I want you to join me.
Peter Capaldi, Jessica Raine, you're both very welcome to Arena. Peter, I'm afraid I'm going to task you with telling us in the easy to understand way, what happens in Season 2 of The Devil's Hour?
Well, what's happened since Season 2 is that... No, Season 1, you mean. What's happened between Season 1 and Season 2 is that Gideon has escaped into the world and embarked upon pursuing his crusade, which is, as you know, if you've seen Season 1, is to eliminate people who are a threat, as he sees it, which he knows it, to innocence, and he is in this season he manages to embroil Lucy into one of these crusades, and the pair of them are drawn into an uneasy relationship, which becomes put under more and more pressure as we move forward into the story. There's a kind of ticking bomb. There's a kind of
absolutely. We have a sense of that. And I must say, as you explain it there, it does sound quite straightforward and quite simple. But we should explain that he has been alive for thousands of years in different versions of himself.
That's correct. We wondered that, how far back he went, didn't we?
Yes.
How far did we go?
What he has discovered is that really the whole show kind of hinges on this notion about déjà vu, that sense that you've been here before, that people feel very, very powerfully. And what Gideon has discovered is that's genuine, that you have been here before. When you stand in that room and you have this sense that this is an experience that you've inhabited before, you've just forgotten, because life is an eternal loop.
Yeah, life is an eternal
loop.
And
you start again. And there can be variations and changes with it. But he has woken up to this. And there are very, very few people in the world who are alert to this. Lucy is now.
Yeah, Lucy is now, as Peter says, Jessica. And the other thing about Lucy is, yes, we do meet Lucy Chambers, the same Lucy Chambers that we met in Season 1, who was a social worker and a mother. And now we meet D.I. Lucy Chambers, who's a different woman altogether in many ways.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she's. You find out a lot about this D.I. Lucy Chambers. We go into her backstory. It's a bit of a sort of left field start to the series, because you feel like, Where are we? What's going on? And we're quite quickly into grown-up Lucy Chambers, who's a detective and is investigating a lot of grisly crimes that, if you watch the first series, they're sort of vaguely familiar. And then as it goes on, you're like, all right, okay, I'm in a detective thriller genre now, okay. And then two-thirds of the way through, that rug gets pulled and we're back into really weird parallel time loops now. So I was playing DI Lucy Chambers and also original social worker Lucy, who has essentially woken up and now holds all the knowledge that Gideon had as well. So it was a real challenge flipping between those two Lucys.
Yeah, I can't imagine it, because suddenly Peter's task seems a lot easier. Be alive for thousands of years, but you're only going to be the one Gideon. You're only going to be the one Gideon on camera. Whereas there are literally, you mean, and schedules, filming schedules the way they are, I'm sure they didn't do. Don't worry, Jessica, we'll do all of DI in the first 7 weeks of the shoot.
I asked for that. Yeah. I really pleaded. I was like, is there any way we can do all of D.I. Lucy in one go? And then, but of course, you're filming, it's locations availability, all of these things are prioritized. So there were days when I was D.I. Lucy at, you know, 8 a.m., social worker Lucy by midday, and then back to D.I. Lucy at 4 p.m. You know, it was absolutely nuts. But it was, you know, I think it's just what adds to the show. Of it, and the way that the audience is really kept on their toes. If you keep watching and really taking note, there are so many things that you'll get back.
Yeah, Easter eggs, as you say. I was glad when you said, when you're watching in that opening few minutes, you're going, what? Who? What's going on here? And then as I tried to explain it before, ahead of our interview, when I tried to explain it to myself, I thought, I can't quite do that, but I know when I'm watching it, it's not confusing. Yeah. You can follow it when you're watching it. However, Peter, we should say you have the extra task in season two of being mobile. You are not chained to a desk for the majority of your speeches. You get to get out and about. And I guess that helped you find new things within Gideon.
Yeah, that was very exciting, because I'd spent I did my entire part for season one in 2 weeks chained to a table opposite Jessica, which was lovely. But in season two, I get to stand up and actually go out the door, and that's fun. And there's a lot of kind of, there's a sort of thriller and action-y kind of element to season two. So there actually was quite a lot of running around and stuff like that. But what was nice was, because Jessica and I were now, our characters were forced into a situation where we had to do stuff together. That propelled us into a different kind of dynamic. And it was they have quite a sticky relationship. Neither of them are really very happy with the way this has turned out, but they have to do it. And that's a joy to play.
They have to depend on each other. They have to work together, whether they want to or not. Interestingly enough, Jessica, the other aspect that I thought of this that must be quite interesting, I have to be careful what I even say in terms of giving things away. Let us say that the relationship with Ravi has changed very quickly and enormously in a couple of ways in season two, within two episodes.
Yeah. I think it's really deeply romantic, the way that whatever loop we find ourselves in, Ravi and Lucy are just deeply attracted to each other. They're meant to be, they're in love, but this is magnetic. So we, as sort of colleagues, in episode one, as police officers, essentially, they're really drawn to each other. And then as social worker Lucy, there's a whole other element to it. She's kind of abandoned him to try and leave him alone to get on with his life, and he's haunted by the things that happened and comes and finds her again and is drawn back into the maze of essentially the high concept of the Devil's Hour. So yeah, I find that really romantic, but in quite a dark way, I suppose.
Yeah, well, you have he has the wonderful, I don't know how they did this, if they did different scenes in the morning and the afternoon. He's a beard in season one, and he has no beard.
Him about
it's no
that.
Beard.
He was, Livid, yeah. That's a beard that's stuck on and off, and he couldn't really smile with the beard on. It must have been he was so like he will say himself like he was a little bit grumpy when he had the beard.
Peter, just one final question, if I could. You do have to speak in riddles quite a lot. You don't have the task of having two characters. I'm sure those lines are not easy to get around. You get your head around.
Yeah, but fortunately for me, they're not riddles because I know the writer. So if I'm stuck, I try and work it all out for myself. But he can fill me in on what I'm actually. So we're always able to keep it right. But also there's an element, you know, it's a show. It has to be haunting. There have to be riddles. There have to be dark corners that you're led into. And it's a great role to be the person that does that, you know. So I'm happy to have riddles.
Peter Capaldi, Jessica Rein, thank you so much for being with us this evening.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
There you go, Peter Capaldi and Jessica Rein talking to us about The Devil's Hours. The season's two, of course, coming to Prime Video tomorrow. And we will be reviewing it. We will be reviewing it along with the adaptation of Jilly Cooper's The Rivals. We'll be doing that tomorrow night as well in our TV slot. And wonderful interview that I had with Victoria Smurfit talking about The Rivals as well. All of that tomorrow night here in Arena, and you'll find out what our reviewers thought about both The Devil's Hour and Rivals. Two movies up for review this Thursday evening. Earlier in the week, I spoke to Jeremy Strong and Sebastian Stan, stars of The Apprentice, this provocative biographical drama that delves into the rise of Donald Trump during his early years in New York's cutthroat real estate world. And Kathleen is here, debut feature film from Irish director and actor Eva Birtthistle, telling the story of a young woman struggling to find her place in the world. Joined this evening by Hilary White and Cara O'Doherty. And we'll start with The Apprentice. It really is about the apprenticeship. Here is a very young Donald Trump with Roy Cohn, who may not be that familiar, but people may have heard Jeremy Strong telling us about him on Monday night's programme. Roy Cohn is quite a bit of work, and he creates another bit of work as he goes along here.
An exceptionally ruthless lawyer, fixer, maker of kings, as it turns out. And he took a young Donald Trump under his wing and taught him the very famous things that Trump lives by, you know, never, ever saying that anything is true about you, denying everything. And basically he is I won't say single-handedly, but very much responsible for the man that we see today.
Hey, that's certainly the
midwife.
That is the thesis that the film is putting across. But within all of that, the young Donald Trump that we see here, our sympathy, I felt, is elicited for the young man.
Yeah, I think that's part of the genius of this film is that, you know, he's so beyond parody in a way, Donald Trump. He's such a cartoon, such a walking punchline that they couldn't have done a straight send-up of him. So what we have is actually this very sympathetic performance by Sebastian Stan, where we see him as he's just sort of like a glorified rent collector for daddy's real estate company. And he's kind of chumpy, and he's a bit sort of, you know, dowdy and gormless. And you see that he just gets swept away by this very sort of Mephistophelian, you know, corporate lawyer and fixer. And he just sort of sees the shiny, you know, sort of road of gold that is laid out in front of him. All these big sort of development deals are secured under the table by this guy, Roy Cohn, who obviously sees that this young fella who's the heir to this massive real estate company is a good investment.
The other aspect of his early life that is explored here is Ivana, his first wife, Ivana Trump, and certainly initially he's totally smitten by her. Let's have a listen to a clip before I come to where it goes after that. This is they've decided to get married, and Roy Cohn, who's Trump's lawyer at this point, has decided they need a prenup agreement. Ivana, played by Maria Bakalov, is none too impressed.
Ivana, look, forget the gift clause, all right? Roy got carried away. Listen, I'll give you $50,000 now, like a signing bonus. All right, come on. The wedding is in 2 days.
$100,000 in my account before the wedding.
$75,000.
$100,000, Reiko.
Ivana, please. Let's talk about this. Come on, don't do this.
Go find someone else. I'm not a trophy wife.
You're going to ruin your life if you don't marry me.
Come on.
1 second, listen.
Why is that?
Because I'm rich, I'm handsome, I have a great family, I'm going to be the number one builder in New York. Listen to me. You're going to have a life you can't even dream of, Ivana. With me. I love you. I love you, okay? I want to have children with you. I want us to grow all together.
That is Sebastian Stan as Donald Trump, Sebastian Stan and Maria Bakalova as Ivana, and this from the film The Apprentice. It starts out with this real love, and she's kind of keeping him at arm's distance. She's engaged at the time, but he wins through eventually. It does go pretty bad, quick enough.
It does.
Tara. Hello, Tara.
Shooting, excuse me.
Cara, with a C.
Thank you. He very quickly starts believing his own lies, and his narcissism, his head is growing by the day. Mm-hmm. So the wheels of power start turning, and the more he becomes more powerful or sees himself as more powerful, the lower of position he sees her in, and things do take a very, very dark turn. And it is graphically shown. It's in court documents, so this moment is based on truth, but
a deposition that Ivana Trump made about a particular sexual assault between the two of them, but then she withdrew that later on. But it was still.
It's in a court document, so it is out there. But it's the power really turns in that relationship.
Briefly, the performances here, particularly Sebastian Stan and Roy Cohn as Trump and Jeremy Strong as Trump and Cohn, and an overall star rating.
Both excellent. I thought Jeremy Strong was superb in this. Again, real vulnerability to a very devilish character, and there's a link to Succession. There is sort of borrowed texture and energy from Succession about sort of a scathing critique of the billionaire class, and I think people who like that show will enjoy this. I am going to give this 4 out of 5. I thought it maybe leaned a little bit too much on foreshadowing towards the end, when Trump is by the end on the table getting sort of hair transplants and liposuction, like sort of Frankenstein's monster. But it's enormous fun. 4 out of 5.
Tara?
4 stars as well. The two of them really are so strong, and I do think it's really interesting. I expected this to be something very different, but what it is a foundation story and an origin story, and we really do see how he has become who he is today.
Mm-hmm. Right, let us move on then to Kathleen is here. Fresh out of foster care, 18-year-old Kathleen returns to her hometown to take ownership of her deceased mother's house. This is a film that stars Hazel Duke, Claire Dunne, Erin Monaghan and Peter Coonan. A cream of Irish acting talent really in there, but directed by another member of that cohort of actors, Eva Birthistle, her debut feature and script here, Cara.
And very strong debut. It's very powerful story of this young woman trying to navigate her way in the world. I mean, she's never had a proper childhood, so now that she is 18, the social workers expect her to be able to manage on her own as an adult, but if you haven't been a child, how can you be an adult? So it's about those very difficult days of navigating and her finding her way in a less than truthful way with a relationship with her neighbours. And that's Claire Dunne and Peter Coonan.
She becomes totally obsessed with the Claire Dunne character called Dee.
Yeah, she shows her some kindness, and bit by bit, Kathleen, whether she sees her as a sort of a stable mother she didn't have or whatever it is she sees in her, she becomes very attached to her and starts seeing a life that she could have if perhaps she was her daughter.
We know that there's a mother-shaped hole in this girl's life. Like, there's flashbacks to scenes.
Tony O'Rourke plays the mother in flashback.
Plays the mother in flashback, yeah.
Let's have a listen to a clip from the trailer here. This is Kathleen, played by Hazel Duke. She's with her social worker, Damien, played by Erin Monaghan, who's kind of dubious about the choices she's making about moving back home, but he's our conscience and our eyes. She is meeting the two neighbours that we've mentioned, Dee, played by Claire Dunne, and Peter Coonan, playing the character of Rory.
Kathleen Carol Dunne, no next of kin. It might feel strange being back here, Kathleen. If you make different choices, things could be a lot better for you.
Hiya.
We've just moved in. I'm Dee.
Hi.
You making any friends?
One.
It's weird now being in the house on my own.
If you ever need anything.
Thanks.
Are we taking in waves and strays now?
She's just lonely. I couldn't have managed on my own at her age.
I like your necklace.
It's supposed to make your wishes come true.
You don't know the first thing about her, D.
Have I something to be concerned about, Kathleen?
There you go, Aaron Monaghan as Damien, the final voice we heard there in that scene from Kathleen Is Here. Hazel Duke playing the title character, Kathleen, Claire Dunne as Dee, Peter Coonan as Rory. Even from that trailer, you get a real sense of the tension and the psychological world that Eva Berthissel, writing and directing debut feature here, brings us into. Has it worked, Hilary?
I think it has, yeah. It depicts that very well. And there's a real kind of turning of the screw in the final act as well, which I enjoyed. I thought it kind of teetered a little bit unsteadily towards kind of domestic thriller hand that rocks the cradle kind of territory, but it walked back quite well, I thought, towards the end. And it has things to say, as Cara was saying, sorry.
I've re-questioned you, sorry, Cara.
About the fostering system, about, you know, how prepared people are by the time they're ejected out into the real world. It is 4 from me.
A solid 4 from you. What are you saying overall, Cara, and stars?
4 stars. It's a solid, compelling drama, and really cleverly, Berthissel, for her first, really keeps that till quite late on. I mean, it could go in so many directions, and we're not saying where it goes, but it leaves you quite, you're left guessing for a while.
And very strong cast, but I think in particular Hazel Duke.
She has this marvellous ability to be quite naive, quite innocent, but then there's a sort of a darker side to her, and she leaves you wondering what's going to do next.
It's a super performance by her.
You said a 4 as well, did you?
Karen?
So it's a very solid double 4 there for Kathleen Is Here. And previously we were talking about The Apprentice. Both of them, I do believe, on general release this very weekend. But that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy researched this evening's programme, as did Paula Shields. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. I will talk with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. And John Creedon will be with you after the news.